Good morning. Time for us to get started today. Good to see you out. We're going to just go ahead and jump right in with a prayer. Brother Ed Fox is going to lead us in that.
To my God and King, I will praise your name forever and ever. Every day I will praise you and extol your name forever and ever. Lord, you are great and most worthy of praise. We thank you for allowing us to come to your house this morning, that we may study and worship and fellowship with one another and encourage one another to live a godly life. Thank you for Brother Edwin and his studies. May we learn much today, and we give you thanks for these things in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen. All right. So, my favorite lesson of what we do is what we just covered. This is my second favorite. It's probably, though, the one that's most, the lesson on openness and honesty, I think, is probably a little bit of a struggle just for theological reasons and considering those things. This one is a little bit of a struggle just because, in my mind, it's probably something we don't think a lot about when it comes to prayer, and it's something that seems a little bit odd to even suggest this. For those who are our guests, we've been going through looking at praying like the psalmists, and we've covered all kinds of topics. We recognize, first of all, that we don't have to pray exactly like the psalmists, and we talked about the fact that the psalms are old covenant, and we're not trying to set them up as a standard for new covenant. And yet, we've recognized that even Jesus in the new covenant used them somewhat as a model. He quoted from them in his own praying. We recognize that the New Testament writers quote from the Psalms extensively. And so we recognize that the Psalms are beneficial for us. So we've talked about various aspects of the Psalms and how they were praying. Talked about believing in the God they believed in, viewing ourselves as they viewed themselves, viewing prayer as the psalmist did, getting ready to pray as the psalmist did. Over the last 2 weeks, we talked about being candid and rigorously honest and open with God in prayer. And today I want to talk about being creative like the psalmists. If there are two things that I think cause us the most struggle with praying like the psalmists, one is the blunt, frank openness and honesty that we talked about over the last 2 weeks. And the other is the figurative style, the creativity that they use. And as I point out in the little introductory paragraph on page 45, it may be just because of my own background in as an English major in literature and that sort of stuff that really brings this out to me. But when we talk about prayer, we recognize that it's powerful. We recognize that it's profound. We recognize that it's serious. And so the idea that there could be anything kind of playful about prayer just doesn't set well with us. But when we read the Psalms, there is a certain amount of playful creativity. Very serious, but they're playing with the language and playing with the words and coming up with the word pictures that drive home, here's how I feel. Here's what I'm experiencing. Here's how they're behaving as they talk about the folks who are coming against them. I don't think anyone would ever mistake the Psalms for a doctoral dissertation. I don't think anybody would ever mistake the Psalms for a legal brief. I think what we would all recognize is that they are poetry, they are poetic, they are creative, they are wrapped in pictures of language that are supposed to open up our understanding as we look at what these psalmists were going through and what they were trying to express. But more than that, it was opening up the psalmist's understanding of what they were experiencing as they worked to put into words what they were really going through, what they were experiencing, what they were feeling, how they thought about God. It opened things up for them. It's obviously not so God can understand them better, right? What do we need to do to help God understand us better? Nothing. I mean, if prayer was just about getting God to understand us, we wouldn't have to pray at all, would we? God knows. God understands. And so this drives home again that the way they prayed was about them and helping them, and it helps us. So we're just going to talk a little bit about that today. we're going to talk a little bit about the creativity that they experienced. And as I point out in the introduction, you may not need to be creative in your prayers to pray effectively. But if we're going to pray like the psalmists, we are going to explore this avenue of how to pray as they pray. So we're just going to talk about being creative like the psalmists. The very first thing that I want to drive home, that I think the important thing that this issue of their creativity, of their figurative language, of the word pictures that they display, the number one thing that I see from this is that this creativity helps them put words to their speechlessness. It puts words to our speechlessness. First question we have today, we so often pride ourselves on something being so grand that it leaves us speechless. It is so great or it's so bad, we can't even put it into words. Why do you think we say things like that? Oh, it was so beautiful, I just can't even describe it. First of all, has anybody ever said something like that? Yeah, we've all done that. Why do you think we jump to that? What is it that we're trying to get across when we say that? Just so your guests know, we got a big, all right, right down here. We got a big, huge classroom in here, so we do have microphones. Don't be scared of them, but if you get your hand way up so our guys can get that to you and everybody can hear you and it can be recorded, that'd be great.
I think when we're considering something like that, we're more or less feeling like we're not worthy of what we're experiencing.
Okay.
You know, it's something that's beyond us.
Not worthy. It's beyond us, beyond our capability.
Thinking, you know, to actually, it's easier to say that than to try to put it into words sometimes.
Okay, sometimes, yeah, so sometimes it is, wow, this is just so amazing, I'm not worthy. Other times it's just, well, this is easier to say than to actually try to think through it. Okay? Anybody else want to add? Inadequate. We feel inadequate. All right. So there's this kind of positive side that's not necessarily a bad thing. Some things are amazingly grand. Some things are amazingly awful. And we don't know the words and we're inadequate and we feel unworthy in trying to put our words to what's going on. On the other hand, sometimes it's not quite so noble. Sometimes it's just the easy way out to say, oh, it was just so amazing, I can't describe it. And it becomes, that almost can become a meaningless expression as it just becomes the easy thing to toss out. Now, here's the bigger question. And maybe you looked harder than I did and found something, but the bigger question is, can you find a passage in the Psalms where the psalmist said, I just don't have any words for this? Is anybody able to find one? Okay, I just want to make sure I'm giving everybody time. I know it's kind of scary to raise your hand in here. All right, oh, here we go. John found one. What do you got, John?
There was one in Psalms 6.
What's he say?
About tears have a voice in the eyes of God. In other words, our crying... He was talking about how his bed, hang on, let me get it here. It says, for the Lord has heard the voice of my weeping. And in it says, all night I make my bed swim. I drench my couch with my tears. My eye wastes away because of grief. And it's just, he's, instead of saying something, he's just crying. He's so overtaken by it.
Yeah, mine in verse 6, this is Psalm 6, I'm weary with my moaning. We've got and then every night I flood my bed with tears, I drench my couch with weeping, my eye wastes away because of grief, it grows weak because of all my foes, depart from me, workers of evil. And the Lord has heard the sound of my weeping, the Lord has heard my plea, the Lord accepts my prayer. One of the things I think we do see is where psalmists say, I've been praying so much, I've got nothing else to say. I don't understand why you haven't responded. And we see this kind of thing here. Go ahead.
In Psalm 19:3, it says, there is no speech, nor are there words whose voice is not heard. It was talking about creation.
All right. There is no speech, nor are there words whose voice is not heard. Of course, Beginning of verse 1, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words. Whose voice is not heard? Their voice goes out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. Now, the question is here, is the psalmist saying, there's nothing I can say about it, or is he saying, we all hear what the world is saying? That God has a testimony that comes through the world and everybody gets to hear it. And so in Psalm 19, that's what I think it's talking about. The world is speaking to us and we get to hear it. And nobody is without that testimony. All right, Benjamin?
Well, in Psalm 39:9, he says, I am mute. I do not open my mouth, for it is you who have done it. Which is kind of ironic because... He's talking about being silent, but he's talking.
Yeah, I'm mute. I don't open my mouth, for it is you who have done it. Now, the interesting thing there is, if we continue on, verse 10, remove your stroke from me. I am spent by the hostility of your hand. When you discipline a man with rebukes for sin, you consume like a moth. And then verse 12, though, it's hear my prayer, give ear to my cry. So it is interesting you bring up, he says, I'm mute, but he's praying. And it seems to me that what's going on here is not so much things are so bad I don't have anything to say and I can't describe it, as much as God, you've struck me as a mute person. This is what you've done to me. Anybody else? Oh, John's got another one right down here. Go on, John. I knew you guys would look harder than I would. Go ahead.
This was Psalm 38, verses 13 and 14.
38, 13 and 14.
But I, like a deaf man, do not hear, and I am like a mute who does not open his mouth. Thus I am like a man who does not hear, in whose mouth is no response.
All right. Verse 12, if we back up to verse 12 and verse 11, my friends and companions stand aloof from my plague, and my nearest kin stand far off. Those who seek my life lay their snares. Those who seek my hurt speak of ruin and meditate treachery all day long. But I am like a deaf man, I don't hear, like a mute man who does not open his mouth. I become like a man who does not hear and in whose mouth are no rebukes. But for you, O Lord, do I wait. It is you, O Lord my God, who will answer. For I said only, let them not rejoice over me who boast against me when my foot slips. Here, when David is talking about being deaf and mute, I don't believe he's talking about his relationship with God. He's not saying, I'm mute towards you, God. He's saying, here are these people that have stood aloof from me, who have laid snares, who are speaking ruin against me. They're meditating treachery, but I don't listen to them, and I don't talk to them. I don't rebuke them. I'm waiting on you, God, to rebuke them. So again, I don't, even though they're talking about this being deaf and mute, it's not, I don't have anything to pray about this. It's the fact that this person over here is speaking against me, but in relation to them, I've become deaf and mute. I'm going to wait on you, God, to deal with that. Somebody else, go ahead.
Well, if they really did say that, the psalm would be one verse. There wouldn't be a whole psalm if that's really how they felt.
Yeah. Yeah. If they're saying to you, God, I'm deaf and mute, boom, we're done. Now, okay, one more. Here we go.
Psalm 40, verse 5.
Okay.
Many, Lord, my God, are the wonders you have done, the things you planned for us. None can compare with you.
There we go.
Were I to speak and tell you of your deeds, they would be too many to declare.
All right. So we found that. Good job. That's one. More than can be told. These are more than can be told. I even looked up the word told. I don't know why that one didn't come up in my search. I will proclaim and tell them, yet they are more than can be told. This is very much like what John says at the end of his gospel, that Jesus did so many works, and yet, if they were all to be written down, the pages couldn't hold them. All right. Yes, sir.
Very similar to 1 Corinthians
2:9.
What God has prepared for those who love him.
All right, so in 1 Corinthians 2:9, we've got that idea of the heart hasn't even imagined what God has prepared. Yeah. All right, so here's the thing that I want us to recognize from this. Number one, all right, so there's a place when we can recognize that it is beyond us. It is beyond us to be able to explore fully and explain completely God's amazing works and power And yet, I do want us to notice how hard it was to find that said in the Psalms. And so what we see from the psalmist, and if you don't have a book, I'm sorry I don't have this on the screen, but I'd like to read this to you. If you do have a book, it's on the bottom of page 45. From J. Ellsworth Collis' book, Longing to Pray, How the Psalms Teach Us to Talk to God. Here's what he said. You've known the frustration, I'm sure, in the experiences of human friendship and love, of saying to someone, I just wish I could find the words to tell you what you mean to me, or what our friendship means to me. So it is that the psalmist wants a new song, and his exuberance is such that he calls on everyone else to join his choir, all the earth, all the peoples. But our wonderful spiritual ancestor doesn't say, as we might, I can't find words to express what I feel. He would see this, I think, as an unholy cop-out. So he launches into rolling phrases of praise, making us the richer for it. The thing that I want us to recognize is the reason why we even want to consider this idea of creativity in prayer is because it puts words to our speechlessness. It is good for us to work through trying to figure out how to say the things we feel like we just can't say. Now, we may, after working at it, finally come to the place of the verse we saw in Psalm 40 and say, it's too much for me. It's too wonderful. I can't comprehend it. And there is the place for that. Obviously, God is going to be more than we can comprehend and put into words. But the psalmists, that wasn't their first approach. They didn't just see something that was amazing or something that was awful or experienced something that they dreaded and feared and hated and were hurt and said, well, I just can't ascribe to you how hurt I am. I can't describe to you how bad they've been. I can't describe to you how great you are. That was not their first response. It was only after working through that. So, how can we overcome speechlessness in our prayers? What do you think? Being real. Okay, just as we talked about in our last lesson, being real. Here's what's really going on. Use the Psalms. Use the Psalms. And that's really the thing I'm wanting us to get to, is that when we read these Psalms, we recognize that they put words to their experiences instead of backing off. Now, here's something, and I know this is probably kind of a hard question to answer. This is one of those, can I read Edwin's mind questions, but can you think of modern examples where either in prayer, if you heard somebody say something in a prayer, or even just in human relationships, something where you heard somebody talking to someone else about something, or singing to someone else about something. That's where my examples come from. Where people have worked hard to overcome speechlessness and come up with creative ways to put their feelings into words. If so, give some examples. I'll tell you one that's on the radio right now. I've heard it. Really like the song mostly. Ed Sheeran's song, Thinking Out Loud. Anybody heard that song, Thinking Out Loud? Some of you may have, some of you may not have. So he doesn't just say, well, I love you so much, I'm going to always love you. Words can't express how much I'm going to love you. He says, when your legs don't work like they used to before, and I can't sweep you off of your feet, will your eyes still smile from your cheeks? Honey, your soul could never grow old. It's evergreen, and your smile's forever in my mind and my memory. Here's somebody that's trying to put into words the love that he feels for this person. And I know that's obviously, we're talking about between people, human relationship here. But what I want us to see is, it could have been very easy. And so let me ask you, ladies, which would be more meaningful to you? If your husband came to you and you said, I just can't even describe how much I love you. Or if he came to you and said, I'm going to love you till we're 70. At 70, my heart is still going to fall just like at 23. Even if when your legs aren't working anymore and I can't sweep you off your feet, I'm going to love you. Will you smile from your cheeks? You're evergreen. Your soul is, and your smile is always in my memory. So ladies, let me just ask you, which would you prefer your husband to do there? B, most of you, because I'm obviously not a wife. Yes, ma'am? You were saying, yeah. Okay. Yeah. You know, the fact is, even we can appreciate somebody taking some time to try to figure out how to put into words the very difficult things. We guys, although, usually take that unholy cop-out and say, well, I'll just find a card. Somebody else figured out how to say it. I know, I'm guilty of that. Anybody else have some good examples that they thought of? Here we go with John again.
One example I see a lot of people are inclined to do this is to write poetry themselves, just like writing a song. And I had found a quote that said, good poetry is the spontaneous overflow of feelings.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder how many poets would think it was just spontaneous. But there's certainly the idea, it's that overflow of the feelings as they put it into words, write it down. Here was one I thought of. This is an old one. Some of you may remember this. Anybody remember Randy Travis? And some of you guys? All right. I know this is going to sound silly to some of you, but my love is deeper than a holler. And I don't remember the rest of the lyrics. That's the only line I remember because I'm not a huge Randy Travis fan. But my love is deeper than the holler, wider than the sea. Yeah, you know, it goes up to the, you know, that's, I don't know that that would ever make it into an American literature class book of excellent poetry. But I imagine whoever he wrote that for thought, wow, that's better than I just can't describe it. Another one that I thought of was a song, Garth Brooks covered it. Billy Joel wrote it. It's called Shameless. And I know I've heard some Christians, they just heard that word shameless. Oh, that's a terrible song. We should always have shame. But when you actually listen to what he's saying is, I'm shameless. I love you so much. I would do anything and I would have absolutely no shame about whatever it is you ask me to do. That's what the song is saying. Now, it's obviously about him writing about a woman, but can you imagine if we were to say that same thing to God? I am utterly shameless. Anything you ask me to do. In fact, there are lines in that song that talk about the fact that I've always been very self-absorbed and I've always been very self-dependent and I've never really needed anybody else, but now I need you and I can't survive without you. Could you imagine putting that? These are the kind of things we're talking about. And so learning that kind of creativity, I understand those things aren't about God, but it's that same working through. Again, I'm just going to suggest that our wives, our girlfriends, I imagine even us husbands and boyfriends would prefer that if our significant others, instead of just saying, oh, I just love you so much, I can't even describe, if they actually tried to work at it. And I wonder if the same might be said about God. Instead of just, oh, I love you so much, God, I can't even put it into words. Instead, we actually try. And so that's what we've got. So let's consider some examples of creativity in the Psalms. Psalm 23:1. What do we see there? We all love Psalm 23. We've all heard Psalm 23. What's the creativity there? Shepherd. I mean, David could have just said, the Lord leads me. Would that have been the same? No. He could have just said, the Lord is a great leader. But instead he says, the Lord is my shepherd. And all of a sudden now there's this huge word picture that benefits us and describes his relationship with God. What about Psalm 18, verses 1 and 2? Psalm 18, verses 1 and 2. Rock, shield, fortress, deliverer. You know, David could have just said, God takes care of me. But isn't there so much more? When God, you take care of me. He could have said that. God, you take care of me. I appreciate the fact that you take care of me. But instead, the Lord is my rock, my deliverer, my fortress, my strong and mighty tower. Now, the very interesting thing is, the very interesting thing is we've heard that psalm so much that we probably don't recognize that as very creative. I mean, we would just say that because we've heard that from Psalm 18. But I want you to recognize that because we've heard that in the psalm and we've adopted that same kind of language, we're actually demonstrating the word picture. The sad part about it is that we may have missed what the word picture is that we're creating. It's not just the Lord takes care of us. He's my fortress. What is a fortress? Well, back in these days, everybody couldn't live in the castle. Why couldn't everybody live in the castle? There's not enough room. And so you've got all these people that are living out and they're working their farmland because, of course, you can't farm inside the castle. But if somebody is starting to attack, what do? Run to the fortress. And that's the picture of God. He's the fortress. He's the shield. He's the rock. He's the deliverer. Excuse me. What about Psalm 59, verses 6 through 7, and verses 14 and 15? What was it? Dogs. My enemies are dogs. He could have just said, my enemies are bad. He could have said, you know, my enemies won't leave me alone. But instead, as he's talking to God, he gives this words picture. They're like a howling pack of dogs that comes back every night. Now, again, that doesn't necessarily mean as much to us. Because, of course, for us, what are dogs? Pets. And what do we call them? Man's. Dogs are man's best friend. That is not the way the Jews viewed dogs. That is not the way dogs have been viewed throughout history. Dogs were a whole lot more throughout history like wolves and wild animals. They eventually got tamed, and that's fine. But these are wild animals that come out at night that are scourge, that eat the chickens, that tear up the fields. And if you're out at night, they can attack people. You don't let your kids go outside at night because the wild dogs might attack them. He says, these are like wild dogs. They come howling around every night. I think they're gone, and then they come back. That's that idea. And not only are they howling dogs, he even takes it a step further. They're howling dogs, and he doesn't just say they're howling dogs with really sharp teeth. What does he say? They're on the prowl. But did you see the thing about swords? There's swords in their lips. Those are sharp teeth, aren't they? I mean, that's what he's saying. So when they bite, it's like swords. All right, Psalm 32, verses 3 and 4. Psalm 32, whoops, it's not. There we go. Psalm 32, verses 3 and 4. Somebody want to shout that out? My bones, Psalm 32, my bones waste away. That's a really creative way to talk about how sick I am. I'm sick. I'm wasting away. I'm not eating. It's not just sick, or it's not just sad. My strength is dried up like from the heat of summer. You ever been out and you just been out in the heat all day long, and it's just like, even if you haven't really been doing anything, it's just kind of like, oh, man, I am wasted. That's what he's saying. That's the way I feel. That's what's going on here. What about Psalm 51 and verse 2 and then verses 7 through 12? Wash me whiter than snow. It's not just forgive me. It's not just please forgive my sins. It's wash me and cleanse me. I want you to think about this. Why is it good for David to move beyond just forgive me to wash me and cleanse me? What is that making David realize about his sin? Okay, it's being removed, but the problem before it's removed, what is he? He's filthy. What does sin do? It makes me dirty. And so him working through this figure helps him realize what sin really is and what it's done to him. And so it's not just, hey God, I need you to understand, but it's the recognition David needs to see of what sin has done. Create in me a clean heart. Let the bones you have broken rejoice. All figurative language. We'll come back to this psalm here in a little bit. Psalm 42 and verse 3. And really Psalm 102 and verse 9. Both have the same kind of imagery. Okay, so he's weeping alone. Both of them. My tears have been my food. Which means what has not been his food? Well, God hasn't been... I don't know about God being his food or not here. But if he's eating his tears, what is he not eating? This is not a trick question. He's not eating food. Food has not been his food. Tears have been his food. He could have just said, I've been fasting a lot. And instead what he says is, tears have been my food. And then in Psalm 102 verse 9, he talks about the ashes being his food. And again, the tears being his drink. So he doesn't just say, here's, you know, not eating, not drinking. Tears have been my food. So we see all of this. Why do you think the psalmist didn't simply make all the above statements with prosaic clarity and flatness? Here we go. Wendy, right up here. Raise a little bit higher, Wendy, so you can see right back there.
Word pictures connect us with emotions. And I wanted to add... I used to kind of think of the word meditation in a bad light because it's connected in my mind so much with Middle Eastern religions and mm-hmm. the idea of making your mind blank. But God talks about us meditating on his word. And the images in Eastern religions, they want you to focus on or nothing. But God's given us the exact perfect things to meditate our minds on. And in times of extreme grief with me, these images he's given us were, if I tried to come up with my own, I wouldn't have. But I read it and I was like, that's exactly what I feel and what I need God to be for me. And exactly what he is. And he's supplied us exactly what we need to be able to meditate on him and have the right frame of mind.
Absolutely. And so we've got this the meditation that it takes, back down here with Benjamin, the meditation that it takes, the time to think. In fact, we're going to talk about this in a few moments. But why not just simply state it? Because it takes the word pictures, it takes the time, it takes the meditation, it takes the energy and the direction of thought to drive this home. Go ahead.
Well, when humans have a lot of emotion, something emotional to express, art is the way we do it. So whether that's literature or music or painting, you know, that's the vehicle with which humans have expressed themselves since the beginning of time.
Okay. Right behind you there.
Well, if we think about, to answer the question as it's presented, you think about the book of Psalms. There's no chapters, right? Because
there's
right. Psalms.
That's right.
It was not written as a book. It was a song. It was collected. If it was flat, if it was prosaic, it wouldn't be in the book of Psalms. So by its very nature, by its definition, the Psalms are going to be these kind of flowing. Otherwise, it would be in 2 Chronicles chapter 14. You know, one of these other spots. I'm troubled a bit by this lesson.
Mm-hmm.
Although in the discussion about Psalm 51 and cleanse me, I think maybe I understand where we're getting at. But just the phraseology, it looks like what the emphasis on is on form and not substance. And despite people often through the arts or their emotions expressing themselves, I don't know, with a lot of flair, in the New Testament, two of the commended examples were not that way. We see the Pharisee and the publican in Luke 18. You know, God be merciful to me, a sinner. That prayer, from what I get out of it, was a very deep expression of this person's emotion, was very simple. Jesus, before he gives the example prayer, talks about the people wanting to be heard for their much speaking and condemns it. The places that talk about great flowing words in the New Testament are not complimentary of that. Now, that's not talking as much as us talking to God as to one another, but in Jude and in 2 Peter, those are condemned. So if these flowing words are coming and as an expression of our heart because we are doing our best to tell God how we feel, then I can see putting effort into that. But there is the danger in focusing on these words, elaborate words, that we become focused on form and not substance, and then we're under condemnation rather than our prayers reaching out to God.
Very good point. I appreciate you bringing that up. I don't want us to, and that's why I tried to point out at the beginning, is that for a prayer to be acceptable, it doesn't necessarily have to be creative. Again, good point regarding the publican's prayer. Lord, be merciful to me, a sinner. That is not very creative. In fact, we're going to talk in a few moments, if we have time here, about Hezekiah's prayers. And remember when we talked at the beginning about why we don't have to pray exactly like the psalmist, is that we have Hezekiah's prayer that he prayed, then we have the psalm that he wrote in memorial of it, which also ties in with the point that's being made. One of the things we have to recognize is that these psalms were not just, here's the prayer I offered in the moment. They were memorial collections of the events of what they're bringing to God, and then also so that it can help us bring what we need to God. And I hope we recognize that. We do not want to be form over substance. Having said that, One of the things I don't think we need to do when we say that is now say, form, we don't ever think anything about form at all. And so that's why I'm trying to maintain the balance here, is that for a prayer to be effective, it doesn't necessarily have to be creative. But if we are going to pray like the psalmists, we're going to explore this avenue of praying as they considered and as they worked through. And one of the reasons, and here's one of the things I have listed for our question here. Why do you think the psalmist didn't simply make all the above statements with prosaic clarity and flatness? I think one of the reasons is, as we said earlier, it's not because God has to understand better what they're going through or feeling. God understands it perfectly. Who needs to understand better what we're going through and feeling? We do. And so, as we said with Psalm 51, as David works through that psalm, he's actually learning something about his sins. Certainly to be forgiven. Lord, be merciful to me, a sinner. But to understand the nature of sin, spending some time in what that means, expanding that, clarifying that, doing the hard work of figuring out what's exactly going on and putting that into prayer is beneficial for us, as it was beneficial for David. And that's the thing I'm wanting us to understand and drive home.
I don't think that these psalmists and these guys that wrote the psalms always prayed like that. That's
no.
Not how they always prayed. They actually sat down and put a pen to paper intentionally.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. All right, so if we're going to try to develop this creativity in our prayer, here's just some things I want to share with you, some ideas that'll help you. The very first thing I want to say is don't be too hard on yourself. Look, you don't have to be Frost or Dickinson or Byron or Keats to pray. As was just accurately pointed out, some of the best prayers in the scripture are not psalms. They're not these creative forays into understanding. They're just the blank, bold statements. Additionally, I don't want us to think about this causing us to be paralyzed so that we feel like we can't pray. If we get to that point of saying words can't express, what does Romans 8, 26 through 27, what comfort does it give us in every aspect of our praying? The Spirit intercedes for us. When we don't have the right words, the Spirit does. And so, as you consider this, I'm not presenting this lesson in any way to cause us to think, oh man, I've got to be a poet to be a prayer. That is not true. Not true at all. So, recognize the Spirit interceding for us. But if you want to pursue this, if you want to go through the work that David went through, in fact, I guess I've just answered my next questions, you got to be willing to work at it. If you want this, if you want to explore praying like the psalmist prayed, and again, I just want to repeat to make sure there's absolute clarity, a prayer does not have to be a psalm to be an effective prayer. And we started with that at the very beginning. But if you want to, you're going to have to work at it. We looked at Hezekiah's prayer in Isaiah. You've got the one in chapter 38, verses 2 through 3. Remember, we talked about that in an earlier lesson. That's just kind of a blank, bold cry of despair that any one of us would feel comfortable crying out and not feel like it took any special background or work to accomplish, right? But then we have verses 10 through 30 that are quite, or excuse me, 10 through 20, which are quite different. I just want you to compare and contrast the work that went into those two prayers. Which one took more work? The second one. The psalm took more work. The first one was just that immediate expression of desperation, which every single one of us would feel comfortable doing. And it was fine. It was legitimate. It was valid. He didn't have to then turn around and write the psalm for it to be an okay prayer. But he does write the psalm. And that's going to be something that takes some work. Go ahead, Benjamin.
Well, and the second one was a contemplative reflection of what God had done. So
yeah.
Hezekiah took some time afterwards to go back and remember and kind of record that for himself, which I think is an important process for us to take some time and reflect on how God has worked in our lives.
Yeah, and by the way, that's one of the things I think we should get from the Psalms, is that most of the Psalms I think we're going to recognize are just like what's happening here in Isaiah 38. They're not, I'm in the midst of this terrible situation, or here's this great situation, or whatever, and wow, this prayer just comes to me and I write out this amazing song. There's a situation that's going on that has prayers a whole lot like verses 2-3, which just basically says, please, O Lord, remember how I've walked before you in faithfulness and with a whole heart, and I've done what is good in your sight. That's the prayer. But afterwards, when God responded, he went back and spent some time contemplating, meditating. What's this amazing thing that God has done? And it becomes something now that can be a model for us in prayer. And so, if we want to learn creativity in prayer, what are we going to have to do? Well, here's the answer. I'm just going to give you the answer on this one. You're going to have to work at it. You're going to have to work at it. It is not easy. It's not easy. It is rewarding. And again, I don't want to make it sound like it's necessary for your salvation. You're not going to stand before God in judgment. He's going to say, well, I recognize you were faithful your whole life, but you never prayed a psalm. That's not going to happen. But it is rewarding as you do that work. Go ahead.
Well, and one of the most obvious aspects of the Psalms is that they are written.
Yeah.
And so it does make a difference when we sit down and write. That forces us to think in a different way than if we're just talking.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it takes work. Anybody sit down and say, you know what I really want to do today is write? I mean, I know there are a few of us that do that, but most folks, I just really want to write today. Yeah, okay. That's what I thought. Kelly does. Oh, no, you're going to say something.
Well, I may have looked at this wrong for most of my life, but after my mom and dad died and we went through a lot of their things, my dad was a prolific writer and a lot of it was comical, but he had written some very serious things about my mother.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the way he talked to my mother. He wrote what he couldn't say. And he wasn't preparing a speech. He was sharing the depth of his feelings in a way that he couldn't put into words and communication. I don't think my mother wanted my dad to write him a speech and then say it. I don't think God wants us to write some thing like that. But the other side of that is taking the time to invest our creativity in a spiritual way where that's our art form. I think that's phenomenal. It shows where our heart is. But I don't necessarily put that on the same plane as that's the prayer I'm going to utter. And I may not be saying that very clear. It's like what Benji was saying. When we take the time to write it, we're going to be much more thorough and thoughtful than if we're just trying to talk. And that's where the spirit comes in.
Did your dad ever give those to your mother? Did he ever show them to her? Yeah, absolutely. And it meant something to her. And that's the thing. Again, so remember, we're building on what we've said before. We go back to the earlier lessons. As we came to this issue, we pointed out that one of the reasons we don't have to pray exactly like the psalmist is because the psalmist didn't always just pray like this. Isaiah 38 is an example. There was the prayer, and then there's the contemplative memorial that comes afterwards that is also in the form of a prayer. It becomes a model, but it is rewarding for us to work through that. And so I think that's one of the benefits here.
One of the benefits of this activity, I think, is in trying to flesh out our thoughts, it forces us to ask the question, why? Why is this a problem? Why is this bothering us? And then we're asking that question in the context of God's presence. And so that forces us to put our problem in the context of his eternal purposes and of his providential care and of faith. And so it oftentimes refocuses our thinking about whatever it is we're concerned about in that prayer, because we've asked ourselves, why is this a problem? And we're in God's presence and we're like, okay, actually I can see that may not actually be a real problem. And, I mean, not always. Sometimes there's, you know, real problems. But then when we see it in the context of eternity, we can still say it's actually not as big of a problem as I thought.
Well, that's what Psalm 73 is. In Psalm 73, as Asaph said, oh, things are awful. Things are terrible. Things are bad. I was going to give up. But then I went to the sanctuary and I realized their end and I understood. So thinking through this is very important. If you want to develop creativity in your praying, or your contemplative review after the prayer, you got to get comfortable with figurative language. Psalm 51 is just chock full of figurative language. Psalm 51, and it's why Psalm 51 is so often misunderstood. People go to Psalm 51 like it's a doctoral dissertation about the nature of sin, and it's not. It's a snapshot in a moment of a man's life who had been convicted of his sin, and here's how he's feeling. And so what does he say? He says things like, blot out my transgressions, as if the transgression is something that's on a ledger that can now be erased. That's a figure. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. That idea of I'm dirty. My sin has made me dirty. I need you to cleanse me. My sin is ever before me. It's the only thing I can think about. As if it's right there. As if it's on a screen and I'm watching it over and over again. Against you and you only have I sinned. Was God the only one that David had sinned against? No, he had sinned against Bathsheba, he had sinned against Uriah, he had sinned against his people, he had sinned against the Gentiles. But his point is, my sin against you is so devastating and detrimental, it's as if it's the only thing that matters. And so then he says, behold, I was born in sin. Was he saying that I was born with a sinful nature? No, that's not what he's saying at all. What he's saying is, look, I feel so guilty and full of shame. It's as if I've just always been this awful, filthy creature. So then he says, purge me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I'll be whiter than snow. Let the bones that you've broken rejoice. Hide your face from my sins. Blot out all my iniquities. Create in me a clean heart. All of this imagery. Why are we so often uncomfortable with figurative language? What's that? It's not natural? We don't use it much? For some reason, I think we have the idea that figurative means lying. If I use figurative language, I'm not saying what I really mean. Somehow in our culture, we have the idea that to speak figuratively means I'm not saying what I really mean. And that is not true. Figurative speech is not saying something other than what I mean. It just says that I have to work a little bit harder to figure out what I mean. In fact, figurative speech most usually is trying to drive home what I mean. Man, he flew like a gazelle down that field with the ball. You didn't know what he meant when he said that? Man, he shot that ball like a rocket. He didn't say what he meant? No, now I understand better what he meant. And so we can overcome this by recognizing that figurative speech is not hiding what I mean. It's actually intended to clarify what I mean. Sometimes figurative speech in the Bible is intended to be like a speed bump that stops us and says, wait a minute, what is this saying? But when it comes to this idea of our communication with one another, figurative speech, we actually do use it quite frequently. We just don't realize we're using it. And we need to understand that figurative speech is not about hiding meaning. It's actually about clarifying meaning. But if we're going to do this, I just want to encourage you, don't be bound by ancient figures. So, purge me with hyssop. What on earth does that even mean? Well, just so you know, because we've only got 2 minutes here. Purge me with hyssop. One, the hyssop branch was often used as a scouring tool, kind of like we use scrub brushes and Brillo pads. If they were going to clean things, they would do that. Number two, the hyssop branch was also what was used ceremonially when they put the blood from the lamb on the doorposts and the lintels at the Passover, when they would cleanse out the utensils for the temple, and also if they had found leprosy in something. And so when David brings this up, purge me with hyssop, he's calling all of that imagery to mind. This is the scrub brush that they would use to cleanse things. And so today, what might we use? Well, we might talk about bleach. Bleach. And you know what? I have this down under just try. That sounds silly. And I will, if you haven't read the paragraph, I will point out, please don't make your public prayers the time for you to experiment with creativity, because that just becomes distracting. All right? So I am going to say that. Please don't use your public prayers here in the assembly as your opportunity to experiment with creativity, lest you distract from what we're actually trying to do. But at the same time, as silly as bleach my soul sounds to us, I wonder the first time someone said, purge me with hyssop, if it might not have sounded the same way to them. Scour me with a Brillo pad. Listen, I get it. I understand how that's, but I just wonder, did the hyssop branch sound somewhat the same the first time David said that? Okay? So, we can use our own modern imagery. And, well, the final thing that I have there is spend some time reading poetry. We're not going to talk too much about that. I do want to make a point because someone sent me a comment yesterday. I have no desire for anyone to go off and read what men have written and get turned away from God. All I'm suggesting here is that we can look at the creativity that others use in various scenarios, and maybe we can learn how to adopt that when we're actually talking about God. But I do agree, the number one place, go to the Psalms. Go to the Psalms and read what they said. That'll help. And finally, you just got to try. You just try it sometime and see if you don't experience the reward there. Thanks a lot, guys.